This is a special edition of Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the premier financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Now, for this special edition of Macro Voices, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Macro Voices All-Stars Episode 83 was recorded on December 9th, 2019. I'm Eric Townsend. This episode of Macro Voices is brought to you by TopTradersOnPlug.com, which happens to be my own favorite podcast when it comes to quant and rules-based investing. Check them out. You'll be glad you did. Alhambra Investments Chief Investment Officer Jeffrey Snyder is back with us this week, and as always, Jeff has prepared a terrific slide deck, which I highly recommend that you download because we'll be making reference to it throughout the interview. You can find the download link next to Jeff's picture on our homepage at macrovoices.com. Jeff, after last week's jobs report, it seems like quite a lot of people, especially those in the United States, are gaining more and more confidence about the U.S. economy. Now, it's been a few months since late summer when everyone was talking yield curve inversion and recession, skies falling, etc., etc. That sentiment appears to have disappeared now, and it's been replaced by growing optimism. I'm not sure if it's just the sentiment or if the economic conditions have truly changed. So, Jeff, I wanted to get you back and get a sense of what you're looking at specifically that might tell you which way things are leaning, not so much the sentiment, but the actual economic conditions. Now, you were talking about a dollar shortage, lower interest rates, and the possibility of a global economic downturn early last year in 2018, while everybody else, it seemed, was just certain of economic acceleration and higher interest rates. Now tables have kind of turned. I think that you were right in many senses that the expectations people had didn't come true, but now they're kind of getting reinvigorated. They think that that things are getting much better now. So what's your sense of things, and what do you have in terms of what you see on your radar screen?
Eric, if we're looking for clues about what comes next, we need to keep looking in those same places as we were looking in early 2018 and throughout 2018 and 2019. It's true that the global sovereign bond market, for example, isn't as pessimistic as it has been, you know, say in late August, but that's not necessarily the same thing as turning optimistic. You know, gradation matters here. Being slightly less pessimistic, and I really mean slightly less, has very different connotations than how the bond market is being currently characterized. Yeah, you know, the U.S. payroll report for November exceeded expectations, but, you know, what about everything else? What was really interesting to me back in November was when the FOMC released the minutes of its policy meeting that it held at the end of October. In the part where they talked about the economy and the risks to it, the committee members made a pretty startling admission, one that they have avoided trying to make or admitting to for many years. Now, normally the U.S. is considered to be the leader of the global business cycle. You know, if you've heard the old adage, if the U.S. gets a cold, everybody else gets pneumonia. You know, as the U.S. goes, so goes the rest of the world. That's what everybody were taught to believe. But as you can see on slide three, policymakers are now concerned about a downside risks in the U.S. economy as it might be negatively affected by economic and financial developments elsewhere. That's a substantial and unappreciated change in thinking, and it's a correct one, in my opinion.
Jeff, the conventional way that central bankers think about an economy, especially the U.S. economy, is that it's primarily a closed system. In other words, monetary policy affects the domestic economy and it stops at the border. You deliver your monetary policy according to your domestic economic needs, and then you count on flexible exchange rates to take care of everything international that happens beyond the border. So if the U.S. economy was strong, that was the end of the story. Weakness occurring overseas somewhere else would never really concern Federal Reserve officials. Is that still true?
Yeah, it's taken a lot of years, but they are starting to realize that's not how it really works. The global economy really is more of a global economy. And if you begin to see serious negative pressures manifesting, you know, in economic weakness in different places around the world, that's something everyone has to be aware of and on guard for, even the U.S., whether it starts out as strong or not. So not only is it important to consider that, you know, this is the way things really are, it's equally important, if not more so, to understand why that is. What is it that has tied all of these, you know, previously closed system economies together into this globalized whole? What I'm talking about here, Eric, as you know well, is we're talking about the Eurodollar system, which is a world-spanning monetary regime. When it goes somewhat right, there's a little bit of growth. And when it starts to go wrong, there just isn't. In very broad terms, it really is just that simple.
Jeff, over the last year, maybe year and a half, just about everyone has been focused on trade wars. When talking about potential overseas turmoil spilling over, all that we've heard from the economists was essentially rehashed Trump tweets, protectionism, and negative sentiment driving the global downturn. The implication, obviously, is that trade wars were, and maybe still are, the central reason for all of these economic questions and concerns around the globe. And if a trade deal was somehow going to be struck, then all this certainty would just go away. How much credence should we put in that logic?
Well, you know, I certainly agree that's how all of this is being viewed by a lot of people. And even on a short-term basis, certain markets have shown a tendency to really focus in like a laser on the president's trade tweets and you know, those of Larry Kudlow and people around him. But you can actually see how those are distracting from what's really going on in the global system. And once you do that, once you get beyond trade wars, I think it gives us a much better position from which to figure out what's the next most likely steps for the global economy. And of course, how the U.S. economy might evolve inside of that too. Germany is a good a place as any to begin. If you go to slide 4, even if it isn't plainly obvious whether or not Germany is or has been in a recession the past couple of years, it is perfectly obvious when everything changed for that economy. Up until the end of 2017, there was modest growth. It was called a legendary boom by officials, but they were just simply overhyping everything because it really wasn't all that great to begin with. You know, setting that aside, whether or not it was actually a boom, right at the beginning of 2018, it's as if someone flipped a switch. The German economy just hit a wall. Ever since then, at best, Germany has been unstable, and at worst, conditions are already consistent with a mild recession. And more important than that, you know, this weakness has lasted for 7 quarters and counting, which is nearly 2 years. So if you flip over to slide 5, you see how it has been German industry, which has been where the weakness is coming from. And again, it's now almost 2 solid years of declines, definitely an industrial recession.
Okay, Jeff, so definitely an industrial recession, but couldn't an industrial recession be the result of trade wars and trade war sentiment? I mean, these trade wars are not just U.S. and China. It creates sentiment about global trade, and it affects everybody around the globe. And if not directly trade wars, then maybe economists are just talking in terms of negative trade sentiment. So could that be driving this?
Yeah, to me, it just doesn't add up either way. You know, President Trump beginning to talk seriously about imposing tariffs on Chinese goods in the middle of 2018 cannot ever explain why the economy for nearly all of Europe clearly ran into a wall at the end of 2017. You can make the case that negative trade sentiment has played some kind of a role here, but number one, it certainly didn't originate the downtrend. And number two, it still doesn't explain how threats of U.S. levies on Chinese goods have had such a sustained negative impact on German industry, and as we'll see, not just German industry. What does explain that, though, is the dollar. So if you go to slide 6 and then slide 7, you see what it is that really changed at the outset of 2018. The euro, which had been rising all throughout the back half of 2016 and then all of 2017, suddenly stopped in January 2018. And the other side of the rising euro, obviously, is the dollar. So in other words, the dollar was falling in exchange value corresponding to economies in Germany and across the rest of the world moderately expanding. But once the dollar stopped falling, all bets were off. As the dollar turned around and began to rise, it changed the entire baseline for the global economy, just not all at once. Germany and Europe were simply, you know, among the first to be affected by it.
Jeff, I think this is a really important point that we want to emphasize for our listeners. Given the way that people are taught about the dollar and how it's talked about in financial media, we're given this perception of the so-called king dollar. Sometimes it's called the strong dollar because the idea is, at least according to public perception, when the dollar rises in value, the reason that it's going up in value relative to other currencies is because everyone thinks that the U.S. economy is outperforming all of the other economies around the globe. Is that right?
Yeah, I know what you mean. And for much of our history before the end of the gold standard, that's what a strong and stable dollar actually did suggest, you know. Except back then, a strong dollar had nothing whatsoever to do with its exchange value. What strong actually meant was something else entirely. It meant that the U.S. economy and its financial system were in good balance and reasonably behaving so that there was no real risk of monetary flight, which would cause the fixed exchange value of the dollar to be threatened. But in a world of floating currencies, the idea of a strong dollar simply doesn't apply. Yeah, some of the exchanges and exchange rates can be explained by textbook factors like higher interest rates and higher growth. But in this euro-dollar system that connects all these economies all throughout a globalized world, a broadly rising dollar means something else, something very specific. And it's, you know, by far, it's the easiest correlation to make. Whenever the dollar goes up in exchange value, bad things happen all over the world. The dollar after Bear Stearns in March 2008 began to rise. Again in 2011, as the second crisis came up. Then in the second half of 2014. And now again in early January 2018. And so, you know, this correlation is so obvious that even central bankers and academic economists have, at least more recently, begun to take notice, as you can see on slide 8. There's actually quite an extensive volume of academic research and a growing volume of academic research, particularly since 2016, which at the very least recognizes that a rising dollar is a bad thing.
Okay, let's elaborate. Why is a rising dollar a bad thing? Who's it bad for? What's the consequence?
Yeah, this is where we get into the weeds of the euro-dollar system and how it actually works. And, you know, Eric, you and I have covered that a lot in the past. So what I'll say here again on slide 9 is that this rising dollar phenomenon is closely associated with these broad range of market indications of illiquidity in that global dollar system. You and I have talked about consistently over the last, you know, 3, 4, 5 years now. And it's uniform, meaning the flip of the switch between a falling dollar and a rising one corresponds almost perfectly with these liquidity signals in the bond market, you know, euro-dollar futures, swap spreads, those kinds of things. So the short version is, you know, if you have slight growth in global dollars, meaning less of a persistent and harmful global dollar shortage, the dollar tends to fall in exchange value and the global economy can grow a little bit. When that changes, as it has four times over the last 12 years, this dollar shortage comes back, the dollar begins to rise again, and then the global economy goes into reverse.
So if this is a global U.S. dollar problem, then it's not just Germany and the euro, which hit a wall in early 2018 before trade wars showed up.
Yeah, well, starting in Europe, we see that in Italy too, on slide 10. And again, it's the industrial sector which is impacted, leading the overall economic decline. And that makes sense, too, in the context of this euro-dollar system moving back toward producing a global dollar shortage. The euro-dollar is a credit-based currency, which means a shortage or growing liquidity concerns that produce instability in the banking sector, global banking sector. So industry and the goods economy are most dependent on credit and monetary resources, especially as they relate to global trade, where the euro-dollar system as a reserve currency really comes into play. And that's why Germany is at the front of the line getting whacked as opposed to, you know, other European countries like Spain, for example. So on slide 11, the monetary pressures that produced weakness in Germany and in Italy are substantial enough to pull the whole European economy downward from moderate growth. And if not into yet a recession, it's been at least 7 quarters of near zero growth, which Europe just simply can't afford.
Jeff, I see from your next slides that this euro-dollar switch was flipped for India as well. Now, I think that's really interesting because you almost never hear about India. Everyone wants to talk about China, and for good reason. But I think the Indian economy, I mean, it's still one of the biggest countries in the entire world in terms of number of people, and it's very important to the growth of the global economy. Maybe not quite as much as China, but more than we give them credit for, more than the news tends to give them credit for.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that, Eric. And there may be a misconception about India's emerging market. You know, China is number 2 in the world, therefore the amount of attention makes sense. But India's economy is actually number 6, just ahead of France and right behind the United Kingdom. It's still got a long way to go to overtake, say, Germany, Japan, or even match China. But up until the last few years, it looked like that was going to happen over the intermediate term. So if you go to slide 12, what we find out is that India is starting to behave similarly to what we see in Germany and Europe. Before trade wars and this protectionist sentiment, right at the outset of 2018, India's economy hit the same wall as those others. And once again, industry was right at the forefront of that growing negative trend. Slide 13, which can only mean one thing. The Indian rupee, which, like the euro, had been moving slightly higher as the dollar fell in 2016 and 2017, it abruptly switched right at the start of 2018. And in the case of the rupee, the peak was just a few days into January of 2018, and it's been all downhill ever since.
Downhill may actually be an understatement. I remember seeing last week or the week before, the economic estimates coming out of India were downright awful. I mean, really bad.
Yeah, that's probably the right way to characterize them. Even if the chart I show you on slide 13 doesn't make the case by itself, you can go to slide 14 and slide 15. Year-over-year growth for India in Q3 2019 was something like 4.5%, which sounds like a lot, but it was actually the worst quarter for India in more than 7 years. The quarter-over-quarter rate, which is what I'm picturing on those slides, expanded by less than 1% for the first time since 2011, and it was one of the lowest rates this century. And as bad as that is, industrial production in India declined by more than 4% year-over-year in September. That's on slide 16. Again, minus 4% maybe doesn't sound too bad, but Indian industrial production has rarely been negative, let alone as negative as 4%. So if you step back and consider that number in the current context, this is the last thing textbook factors would predict. Tariffs on Chinese imports into the U.S. mean that India is in a position to benefit from trade diversion. On top of that, the currency is depreciated by more than 10% since the beginning of 2018, and this should have boosted the economy again, according to the textbooks. Instead, the opposite has happened. So if we're looking for signs about how the global economy is faring, especially in recent months, whether this euro-dollar-driven economic risks are really diminishing, then India, like Europe, isn't offering us much encouragement. And of course, that only adds to the continued problems in China, which, you know, I've included the obligatory charts for the Chinese economy. You can find them on slide 17 and slide 18. And they show just how little nominal growth there has been in that place, which places China right into the same euro-dollar bucket as Germany, Italy, India, and as well as a whole bunch of others around the world. Dollar, not trade wars.
Okay, Jeff, so let's tie this all together and bring it back to the United States. If you're looking out over the next 6 months, I know you, Jeff, are not terribly interested in Trump tweets or trade deals. You're more focused on global dollar liquidity. Putting those factors together with various overseas economic accounts, what is your broad survey of global economic conditions telling you about what we should expect?
Well, the short answer is, you know, far from being over, there's as much, if not more, to be concerned about today as there was in late August. That's probably why, even though Treasury yields, for example, have moved a little higher, they haven't moved more, even with last Friday's payroll numbers. It's just too soon to call for the reflation or anything else. Still more of the downside risks that are apparent across the entire global landscape.
Jeff, we've been talking for many months now about this U.S. dollar liquidity shortage globally, and that has coincided with a very strong upward trend in the U.S. dollar index, the DXY, at least until the 1st of October it did. In the last few weeks, a bunch of people are saying, okay, that's it, with the declaration of QE, which we're not going to call QE, but a lot of our guests have said QE by any other name is still QE. Hey, baby, it's over for the dollar relative to other currencies. The dollar has topped in early October, and it's all downhill from here. Does your view about this continuing dollar liquidity shortage necessarily disagree with that? Would you expect that the dollar index is going to turn around and move higher? Or is it possibly the case that maybe your outlook doesn't necessarily imply the DXY moving higher at the same time?
Well, it's never a one-to-one relationship. When I'm talking about dollar shortage, it doesn't necessarily mean that the dollar's exchange value goes up by the same amount as global liquidity falls. But if we're talking about the general overall environment, yes, as long as there's a global dollar shortage, you would expect that the dollar would rise in exchange value against, you know, a broad survey of other currencies. Again, one of the most obvious correlations to make, what I put on slide number 8, long time ago, academic researchers realized that when, you know, they focus on the U.S. dollar, it is a bellwether for global financial conditions. So if we see all of these negative signs as far as those leading us in the direction of a global dollar shortage, we would expect the dollar to rise in exchange value. And then if you're talking about sentiment in the global economy, that's where the negative sentiment comes from. Dollar going up is only bad things. And what I see from global bond markets and these financial and market-based liquidity indicators is that that trend hasn't broken. It's taken a step back since August, but that's how these things go. Markets never go in a straight line. There's always this ebb and flow. And for over the last couple of months, to me, it's just, you know, the dollar shortage is still there. It's just backed off a little bit. And that's just a natural trend of how these things develop.
Jeff, this past weekend, Reuters had an article out describing how the Bank of International Settlements has released a paper describing, in their opinion, perhaps it was stinginess in lending by the top four U.S. banks that contributed to this crisis in the repo market. That article prompted a tweet from Ted Darling, one of our regular listeners, who says, "I would love to hear Jeff Snyder and his take on this. Macro Voices has been all over this. Jeff has been talking about the U.S. dollar shortage." And essentially, I'll paraphrase here, I think Ted's real question is the reason that these four big U.S. banks have been stingy about lending, is that just a result or a symptom of this U.S. dollar liquidity shortage that we've been talking about? Now, Ted, I have to warn you, I asked Jeff off the air, can we spend a minute at the end to cover a listener question? And he said, no, that would take a half an hour. We could do a whole show on it. So I'm going to try to rein Jeff in here. We can't do a whole another show here. How about the executive summary for Ted, Jeff?
Yeah. I don't know if the executive summary might take 15 minutes.
Well, go for it. We'll do it.
No, I'll try. You know, I read it's actually the BIS quarterly review for December of 2019. And it's very interesting stuff. I've always complimented the BIS, especially in 2016, 2017, as I said before, being one of the few mainline academic outlets that have been interested in what they call this dense matrix of dollar liabilities that exchange offshore, what I call the Eurodollar system. And yeah, in the quarterly report, the latest one, they talk about the repo thing that happened in September. But if you actually read what they're saying, the short answer is they're not really sure what happened either. And even when they do talk about some of the specifics, I don't think they realize the implications of what they say. And I'll give you an example. I have it on my screen here on page 13. Which is in the box dealing with the repo market problem in September, they even say, there's this massive shift that took place somewhere around 2016 and 2017 where the U.S. banking system as a whole, hitherto a net provider of collateral, became a net provider of funds to the repo market. And then they use that as a way to say, well, if they're the net provider of funds, any problems with U.S. banks, whether they become shy or whatever, that causes them to deny the repo market of funds, but it doesn't appreciate that switch and what it says about the supply of collateral into the system. If the largest banks, which were dependable supply of collateral to the system, are now a switch completely to become a supplier of funds, and I know that this is a complex topic and I'm trying to do this in a short way, but what that does in the collateral side is it says that, hey, the market on the collateral side is going to be short too. And if there's nobody else to step in, it almost doesn't matter about the provider of funds, which, you know, by the way, if you get to the page 14 and when the BIS quarterly review starts to talk about the rest of the repo market, what they say is, okay, there's other things out there that we aren't going to discuss here. And so the short version is, yes, I think that the global dollar shortage gives us a good answer of what happened in the repo market. And what the BIS did is said, we're going to repeat to you all the things that you've heard about banks holding more treasuries and big four banks becoming a net supplier of funds. But oh, by the way, when you get to page 14, there's a bunch of other stuff that happened that we're not going to talk about because we're not really sure what happened either. So the short answer is yes, the global dollar shortage, I think, tells us what's going on in the repo market. And the BIS thing is a way of saying we got to address it because it's an important topic. But we're not really sure either because a lot of things have happened. We're not really quite sure how to connect all the dots.
Well, Jeff, we can't thank you enough for another terrific interview. We look forward to getting you back in a couple of weeks for another update. This episode of Macro Voices All-Stars was made possible by TopTradersUnplugged.com, my favorite podcast when it comes to quant and rules-based investing. And remember to head over and listen to my conversation with its host, Niels Kastrup Larsen, which we released on September 7th, 2019. To get the slide deck that Niels shared, head over to toptradersunplugged.com/macro slides. And as a listener of my show, you're also able to get Niels' latest book for free by going to toptradersunplugged.com/macro. For the Macro Voices Podcast Network, I'm Eric Townsend.
concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Please register your free account at macrovoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly research roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week, free of charge. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts, Eric Townsend, shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices.